Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday, the 5th of September. We're on Triple R every weekday morning from 6 till 9 a.m. broadcast live from Wurundjeri country, Melbourne, Australia. Coming up on this podcast, you'll hear former Breakfaster Lauren Clark, who shares the making of her new documentary about her father, but also John Clark. And head gardener at Fed Square, Russell Lark, comes in to chat about the planting party that's happening as part of a Reset Festival.
Sydney became the seventh major world marathon over the weekend, and to celebrate, Guinness World Records tumbled. And author and OC's fan Andy Griffiths talks to us about best worst gigs and his new book, You, Me and the Peanut Butter Beast.
Filmmaker Zoe Coldham takes us on a trip down Melbourne memory lane with her documentary Gore Street, Fitzroy. And Friday Fuddy Bugger and reluctant bird watcher Jonathan Schuster confesses that he's far from a plover lover. Triple R. Lauren Clark is a television writer, columnist for The Big Issue, creator of the award-winning audio fiction radio serial The Fitzroy Diaries, children's author, judge for the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards, and memoirist of Would That Be Funny? Growing Up with John Clark. Lauren is now parlayed her imposing storytelling talents for the big screen with the new documentary, but also John Clark, which premiered at MIFF and enjoys a nationwide cinema release tomorrow. And to tell us about this eye-opening cinematic celebration of one of Australia's and New Zealand's most loved satirists, the world's best daughter and former breakfast joins us now. Lauren, welcome back to the studio.
Never have I ever been disappointed by one of your interviews. Ever. It's just, I mean, it's its own show.
Well, you're a very special person, and you're not wearing headphones. Is anything it's working
nothing,
today?
Nothing's working, but it's not.
I fixed them.
That's because you're a human being and I couldn't manage
but
that.
But the chair was busted.
Look. You know what? A bad workman blames his tools.
Ah, exactly. Nice.
That's what my grandfather
said.
Used to say to me. Because I would say things like, the tea towel's a bit wet, so I can't dry the dishes properly. Blames his tools, and I'd be like, "Shut up, granddad."
That's
anyway,
legitimate, God. I think.
There are so many pearls in this movie, and evidently in your life. I know it would have been taxing to document it, but have you lanced a boil here?
You know what? Putting it that way is a much better kind of like sort of characterization of what the experience was, because often people sit down and I get why they say it. They say, oh, geez, you know, you lost your dad all of a sudden sort of 8 years ago and now you've done this. And I also wrote a memoir which was, you know, partly about that guy. And so, you know, like they don't quite say, wow, how sad, what's with the dad obsession?
Yeah.
But that's a little bit sort of like just a little kind of element of which I completely, as I say, which I completely understand. However, for me, it really does, like there is oceans of footage in this film from my ridiculously fun childhood, and you kind of can't be part of that and not think, oh, actually, I've had a pretty good time, haven't I? Yeah, you know, pretty fun. And it's what Mum said when I actually, one of the reasons I ended up making the film is that other people were sort of thinking they would, and they would have done a credible job of it and it would have been fine, but we had so much extra stuff. We had, I mean, I'd sat down and recorded Dad in my little podcast studio, which I'd set up, you know, with Stu Farrell to do our podcast together. And I just would, Dad would be over and he'd be having a cup of tea and holding a baby. And I'd say, sit down there and I'll ask you about your life. Oh. And so I knew we had stuff like that. We had like hours of that. And we had other stuff that other people didn't have. And it just sort of felt slightly wrong if we'd done a film about particularly a satirist whose, you know, job is to kind of look at like sort of the hagiographic and the mythological and like go, let's pull that apart a little bit. If I'd done something similar, so I sort of was a little bit tempted to do that. And but you're right, it was complex to do, but it was actually a really, like all of those myths about, you know, is it a cathartic experience to create something about your own life and particularly a loss, turned out to be dead right in a way.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And He's held in such high esteem, weirdly high esteem by literally everybody.
Annoyingly high esteem, it might be argued.
Spill the dirt. Tell us what you really think.
Do you know what? Actually, it's funny because that was one of the big problems when we were trying to get the money up to make the film. People would go, but you're the family, because I'm the family.
Yeah.
And they say, you're the family, and you know, you loved him. And other people loved him. And they literally asked me at one point, we sort of want to know, like, what was John Clark's dark side?
Yeah, where are the skeletons in the
literally,
closet?
And we laughed, and then we went, oh, no, they're serious. And I thought about it. I thought, I know what they mean, like, that's partly why I want to make the film is, it's going to be a tribute because people aren't going to say. I mean, I mentioned the dark side thing to Andrew Knight, who's a TV writer, and I said, and this was, we were slightly off camera and out of shot and we didn't end up using it in the film, but I said to him, oh, yeah, the ABC, when we were talking to them initially, they were like, yeah, look, love all of it, but sort of want to know, like, what was his dark side? And Andrew goes, oh, do we really need to mention the serial killings? And, like, it got to the point where the crew, we all knew that I would spend a part of the interview going, yeah, but, like, what surprised you about it? Like, but did he annoy you? Did you have fights? Like, trying to get that stuff out of people. And I ended up realizing that actually my job here isn't to, like, uncover his, you know, crack habit or his secret family or something. My job here is to go, well, okay, so if this is the guy and everyone says nice things about him, like, why? Like, how did he get to be that? I think that's more interesting. Mm. And if you look, it's his complex answer. Like, he was actually quite a complicated dude in a couple of ways. Mm, like, yeah. So,
but that's so interesting that the dumb binary idea of a good story.
Yeah, totally.
Light and dark.
He needed to be like, setting bunny rabbits on fire on a weekend or something. Yeah. You know.
But the anti-authoritarianism is really I don't know. There's a lot of ways to skin that cat of being anti-authoritarian, and you skinned it in the most amazingly creative way.
Yeah, he. It's funny because he resisted. Well, part of the thing I think that made me sort of slightly protective of the not necessarily this story, but like the sensibility of the film is that he resisted like labels and like so you'd say, hey, you didn't have a great relationship with your dad, so like maybe you're trying to prove something to him, or you'd say, you know how you're being funny all the time. Maybe you want people to like you, and so you present him with all these things, and he'd always go, yeah, like he wouldn't say that's not true, but he'd always go, is it slightly complicated? But you can see, and it's sort of, I mean, this is in the film, you can see how it was possibly always in him, but geez, the conditions were right. Mm. Like, oh, I know, let's put you in a suburban, you know, white bread Kiwi town straight after your parents have come out of the worst, historically, in the one of the worst experiences in Western history, World War II. Mm. And then let's chuck you in a school for boys that's a private school that's got rules that make no sense, that prop up a sort of, you know, British idea of who we are, and let's see how you go, bro. Yeah. And he's just gone, ha ha. I think not. But yeah, so it's an interesting story.
But it's such a great story as well, like him coming through that school and his parents coming through the war and that kind of trauma, and I don't know, it was just the resilience of his spirit, like that's what he chose. I love that he kind of stated that explicitly, kind of like, you won't break me.
Yeah, that was one of the things I think that's why, like, people say, how did you think to sit down and ask him questions and record it? And partly that was because Farrell told me I should, because we had him on the podcast once. He's like, you should ask him stuff on so that you've got it forever. Mm. Bless his cotton socks. But part of the reason though that I think I felt compelled to do that is that I was constantly asking him my entire life, yeah, but what do you mean you just decided? Mm. Right? Like, so he decided really early on that he, his dad, as his dad was extremely unkind to him for reasons that he saw very early as mixed up reasons, and he just sort of went, ah, that's a shame for that guy. Like, he didn't actually internalise it.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's a kind of a, I don't know, like, is that nature or nurture? But he just went, yeah, nah, I'm not gonna listen to that. I'm not gonna care that the school is telling me I'm hopeless. I mean, he couldn't have been told he was hopeless more.
Yeah, and like you were saying as well, there was, I mean, this is more just me as a comedian and it, like, just the nuggets of wisdom in the film, but there, you know, there is such nuance in his experience, like, you know, what you were saying, and he kind of never succumbed to the labels, but then also as well, just to simply put as well, how he, what he adapted from growing up with his parents, the ability to come at a joke or an idea from two different sides, you know, like, that seems, yeah, I was like, wow, that's incredible, because, you know, that's what you want to do. You want to surprise people.
I'm so glad you got that out of it, because one of the other things I was trying to do was not, because he says in those little interviews that I did with him, yeah, I don't think it's about my biography. I think maybe my perspective might be, if anything, the more interesting thing. And, you know, several times during the making of it, I was like, Dad, you can't have a perspective without biography.
Yeah.
But it is, like, as you say, like, that I think too, that creative people, like, you don't need to know, and this was a test, a litmus test I gave myself all through the making of the film.
Mm.
You don't need to know who he is to like the film or to get something out of it, because I think we all have those instincts, and like, where do you know, like, where do you draw a line in the sand, and like, that ability to like make fun with the person standing next to you who you've met 5 minutes ago is just one of the joys of life.
And also the stupidity, there's so much dumb humour in the film as well.
Hilarious. Could the man fall backwards over a fence any more times? I mean, yes.
But even like, dumb puns that are just so laugh out loud funny.
And like the rhythm stuff. Like I was watching it recently because, you know, now that it's out of my brain and into the world, I quite like, which is like going to, it's like being in a theatre show, you get to see the audience respond to it. And one of the things I thought was, some of those jokes are just about rhythm and timing, like, and they are so stupid. Like, there's one where somebody says, "And do you think there's an element of greed in all this?" says some journalist, and he goes, "I think we're all agreed." And then off he goes. It's like the stupidest thing. There's no point to it at all. Mm. But it's like, yeah, it's a good time.
But it's very understated, and there's no mayo on it.
No, I know. Do you know what was actually really hard, mayo-wise? Editing it, because he's edited or he's been edited already so precisely, because most of his stuff. So actually, if you try to, if you're like, oh, we need a, you know, 3 second thing in between some other things, it's like, good luck, buddy. Unless it is built as a 3 second thing, you ain't going to crowbar that baby in anywhere.
And John Clark was mad for making vines, as we all know.
It's that era.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we have to see the film. We've got to go to the cinemas and see it on the Father's Day weekend.
Yeah, have to. It's compulsory. There are 3 screenings this week, actually, starting, what day is it? Yeah, starting tonight. Where I'm doing a Q&A afterwards that you don't have to listen to now because you've heard me rabbit on. But there are also screenings at any, you know, anywhere near you right across Victoria. And, yes, it's really helpful if you see it between now and Sunday.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, congratulations.
Thanks so much.
What fun. And what was a little boy getting into trouble.
Yeah. A little boy who always found himself getting into trouble.
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful...
That's my boy.
Yeah, exactly. Lauren Clark, thanks so much.
Thanks heaps.
Triple R. Digger is away this week for Down Dirty, but we are delighted to be joined in his stead in studio by the former senior curator of the Royal Botanic Gardens and the current head gardener at the Melbourne Arts Precinct, Russell Larke. Welcome to Breakfasters.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Now, what on earth is the head gardener at Melbourne Arts Precinct?
Yeah, it sounds pretty impressive, doesn't it? So it does. The Melbourne Arts Precinct is kind of an organisation that looks after Federation Square, but also looks after the coordination of all of the arts precincts, so the Arts Centre and the NGV and all of that sort of stuff. So we are building a huge new garden called Larkbundup. If you can imagine from the kind of south side of Hamer Hall all the way behind the Arts Centre, the NGV, down to South Bank Boulevard. So we're talking, you know, around 20,000 square metre garden.
Nice.
It's going over the top of City Road. Uh-huh. So it's effectively a huge rooftop garden and something we've never seen the likes of in Australia, that's for sure.
Okay.
So,
is this, there's going to be a contemporary gallery there, isn't there, at some
there
point?
There is, yes. I just focus on the garden, but there's actually a pretty impressive gallery going there. So the NGVC, yeah. So that's a huge project that'll be sitting basically down the southern end, uh-huh, right near South Bank.
Now, what about those waves, you know, by Hamer Hall?
Yeah.
I forget what the art... Those
the,
arts...
The Ford Surge I've learnt since I became
there
a head
go.
Gardener.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Now, what do you have to do for that? The grass all around there is pretty good for something that gets trodden on all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, so all of that is going to be turned into like a naturalistic landscape. So we're digging up the lawn and we're putting in... There's going to be around 30 species per square metre of all of these really floriferous... That's the word of the morning.
Yeah.
I don't think I've said that for about 10 years. But yeah, yeah, write that down,
what
kids.
Does it mean?
Yeah. Just very flowery.
Oh, very fluorescent or flowery. Yeah,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. So the idea is to have kind of interest all year round. And yeah, so basically it's a kind of new style of landscape. It's kind of naturalistic planting, which people respond to in a much different way. So it's not like a hedge and a couple of plants. Like it becomes kind of an immersive experience, which is cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we be trusted with all of that beauty there in the middle of the city?
Totally. I think you can. So we've got what we call the test garden at Fed Square at the moment.
How long has that been around?
That's been in since December.
Okay.
It was planted. And we thought perhaps there might be some damage and all of that sort of stuff. But what we're finding is people absolutely love it. So they don't want to hurt it.
As you're walking along Birrarung Mar in between Fed Square, that one?
No, it's actually up the top near the entrance to the Fed Square car park. So it's the Russell Street extension.
Oh,
you can access it like Street. From the Birrarung Walk or whatever. But yeah, it's the extension of Russell Street.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm actually busting, like, I told this story last week, that there was like a tradie who was parking at Fed Square to do his work and he's taking photos of like pink flowers. I'm like, you're busted, man. He's like, I know, dude. Like, so it's connecting with like, you know, everyone. New demographics.
Nice.
Cool. Yeah.
Can I ask as well, what kind of considerations go into what like species of plants you select for like, urban gardens like this? Does like the artificial light play a factor at all?
Yeah, totally.
Like
and
that?
They can be really hostile landscapes, you know, with reflected heat and the wind effect and all of that sort of stuff. So the landscape architects has to do a lot of work on modelling the amount of light and the amount of wind that's going to be there, the amount of water that we're going to need because it's a modified substrate. It has to be quite light because you can't have too much weight on a roof. So, yeah, basically the plant palette is native and indigenous species, so locally indigenous species and Mediterranean species predominantly, so things that can cope with drier climates and that sort of stuff. So the idea is to build the most sustainable garden that we can.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, there's a free festival going on for greener living and it's called the Reset Festival. That's right?
Yeah.
And now there's a planting party going on.
Yeah, this is the best.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean, it's spring, people. Like, you've got to be planting at this time of year. Mm. So basically the Reset Festival, I'm going to call it a festival.
It is. It's
yeah,
a festival.
Totally. It's a month-long celebration of, like, how you can contribute to sustainability and greening and all of that sort of stuff. So there's a whole bunch of artists that are doing some installations. So there's, like, sound installations and textiles and sculpture and that sort of stuff. There's going to be a whole bunch of community groups contributing. There's, like, a full kids schools program, so there's like mini bass disco, so if you want to get your groove on, that's pretty cool. I just have to take my daughter to that stuff because it looks weird when it's just me, but, yeah, I get away with it now, which is cool. Nice. They would have kicked me out a few years ago. So yeah, a whole range of stuff, and it's all free, which is really cool. So you know, the Fed Square crew really want to make this stuff accessible to everyone. Mm. You know, so
as a part of this, there's going to be a pop-up site.
Yes.
Okay. Now, are you in charge of that?
I'm not in charge
okay,
of it, thank
but,
God.
But yeah. What is it going to be?
Yeah. So basically in the morning, there's probably 10 or 11 sites across Melbourne where people are going to go out and plant local indigenous species along creeks and waterways, so north and south of Melbourne, and that's in conjunction with Landcare and Creative Climate, which is really cool. And then hopefully we get all of those guys back to Fed Square, and we're calling it the kind of planting after party, you know. So this is also like, it's like a mini festival. So we've got like Marquee set up. We're going to have a whole bunch of different community groups, like Billy Nursery, who are going to run a propagation workshop and have plant sales, that sort of stuff. There's Emma Stenhouse, who's like a First Nations woman who does so much cool art stuff. So she's running some workshops. I did one with her last year, which is awesome. There's going to be tunes. So I think I'm just trying to. They're going to kill me at Fed Square, but I can't. Mm. I can't remember who's going to be there. But there's
the old waivers.
Yes, man. Thank you. Saved my bacon. Yeah. I never forget a plant name, but I'm shocking with everything else. So I think they get nervous when I do this stuff. You know.
Yeah. No. Go on.
Yeah, and then also some chats to like First Nations people about, you know, country and urban ecology and that sort of stuff, and Dirt Girl for like all the kids out there is going to be kind of emceeing the whole event. So that's pretty rad. She's awesome.
That sounds mad.
Yeah.
So now that you're the inaugural head gardener at the Melbourne Arts Precinct, do you look over the road at the greenery of the other joints and go, do you get melancholy, or do you ever go back home to Cranbourne or whatever? I mean, it seems pretty urban where you are right now without a garden
yet. Yeah, totally. And do you know, that's actually one of the reasons that I went for this job, because I can see the opportunity. So for anyone who knows things like the High Line in New York, like this is a chance to build like a new identity in the city of Melbourne, you know? So I think, like I always say, this is a Field of Dreams reference, but if you build it, they will come, you know, and that's the people, but it's also like all the local bugs and birds and all of that sort of stuff. So I just think this is, you know, probably a chance of a lifetime for me personally, but also for the city to build an identity around this garden. And there's a whole bunch of work looking at how we can interpret the garden and have community programs and all of that sort of stuff. So,
Hang on, when you say build it and they will come, the bugs, are we talking like blue banded bees?
Totally,
lots of like,
man.
Native.
I'm so proud of you. That's
He just wanted to drop that in so bad. Blue banded bees. Like,
that's a mic drop, really.
Yeah.
So blue banded bees, but there's a whole bunch of little native bees and grasshoppers and flies and wasps and all of that sort of stuff. And we're seeing a lot of them already in the test garden, which is cool. So it'll be really interesting to see how that translates into the big garden.
Awesome.
Yeah.
There's some love on the text line as well for the text garden. Someone saying they visited during MIF and they thought it was absolutely beautiful.
It's pretty wild. It's really cool. Yeah.
But, of course, Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams didn't have to deal with government and there was no bureaucracy or committees. Do you get carte blanche, or is it – how much autonomy do you have?
Yeah, quite a lot when it comes to, like, it's a complex build, you know. Mm. There's a lot of partners, like, so I've got the main landscape designers, but it's been delivered by, you know, we're a Victorian government agency. But if there is any, I've been shielded by it so far. Like, nice. Everyone's actually really excited about it, like all the project managers and all the people at MAPCO. And, I think there's a real buzz, you know. The fact that this got up in the middle of the city is amazing. Mm. So people are really pushing for it and getting behind it. So that's cool.
And it'll be, how are we going to access it? How do we get behind?
Yeah, well, it will be totally accessible from Hamer Hall all the way down to South Bank Boulevard. So it's been graded for anybody. So you can get a chair through there. You know, it's a pretty mellow kind of walk.
I cut through there, and I'm the only one that I've ever seen buddy do it.
Yeah, well, it's going to be open 24/7 as well. So it'll be really cool for the locals, like who live on South Bank and that sort of stuff. Like, there's a little cut through from the station. You can just immerse yourself in. I shouldn't say my pretty plants. Pretty plants. Yeah, don't touch them. No, I'm joking.
This is very exciting stuff. All right, and so what personal deadlines do you have, or what deadlines are there for the broad thing, and putting aside the planting party?
Yeah, so because it's a really complex build, it's hard to talk exactly about deadlines, but we're looking to start the planting in the big garden in autumn 2027, and it'll take, you know, a good 3 or 4 years after that to get it going.
All right, nice one. And then the planting party at Fed Square, it takes place as part of Reset Festival, Sunday 7th of September, and there are various planting locations, as you've alluded to. Perhaps head to the Fed Square website for more information.
Yeah.
Can I read a couple out?
Yeah.
Darabin Creek Reservoir, Riddles Creek Macedon, JC Donath Reserve Reservoir, Merri Creek, Northcote, Hillcroft Park, South Morang. Yeah, there's a bunch there if you go to landcarevictoria.org.au/planting.
And that word again, floriferous?
Yeah, floriferous, word of the day, people.
Russell Clark, good on you, and we'll chat again soon, hopefully. Thanks
guys.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
Thanks so much for being here. It means a lot.
On Sunday, Sydney became the seventh major world marathon around the world, so alongside Boston, London, Berlin, Chicago, New York and Tokyo.
Wow.
Sydney it joined happened. The likes of those. Yes, it did.
Wow.
So, yeah, what that means is it belongs to the elite Abbott World Marathon Major Series. So, obviously, they have to reach a certain amount of criterias and it's assessed over several years. But it comes down to the way that the event is run, the level of participants and, you know, being a beautiful global city that attracts tourism. And yeah, it's an exciting thing that Sydney has become one of those majors.
So now you'll consider it.
I will. I'll consider going up there. You know how I'm incredibly loyal to Melbourne. I mean, the Melbourne Marathon's fun for me. To be honest, I don't think I could do a marathon. But yeah, lots of records were set. So Ethiopia's Haile Mariam Kiros, he produced the fastest runtime in Australia to win the men's event in 2 hours and 6 minutes, 0.06 seconds.
That is humming.
It's very fast.
Well, that's about six men's off the world record.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay, so the world record is what, just 2 hours?
Yeah.
That's some quick maths on my behalf. Watch out, here she goes.
Didn't even have a notepad.
Yeah.
That was in the head. That was in Nat's head.
And then, yeah, it was also a record, I believe, on Australian soil for Dutch runner Sifan Hassan, who finished first for the women's, and she did it in 2 hours and 18 minutes.
Oh, that's not far off world record either.
Look at you, it's wow. Encyclopedia of the World Records.
Which I haven't looked into it, but usually the world records are set on very flat, like, so Berlin's very flat course, I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Where Sydney, you know, whenever I ride my bike in Sydney, it's not the flattest place, so people are going pretty quick, I reckon.
Do they change the routes each year, to your knowledge?
Generally, like Berlin, now I'm thinking about New York and London would be pretty much the same route.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Have you run either of those?
No, I've I mean, people have asked.
Yeah.
And they figure if I did, it would lend it more credibility, but I'm holding off for a better offer.
You probably would have seen the – did you ever see the New York one go past?
Yeah. Yeah, I have seen that. And it's certainly I don't know, like the Sydney one, I have friends who have run in it, and it would be – that would suck because obviously there are Formula One cars, Formula One tracks that benefit different types of driving as well. So I guess it happens.
Mm.
But does that mean Australia is going to get a reputation as a particularly hard global marathon? Because
it's
because of the gradient.
Yeah, because New York, I would imagine, be pretty flat.
Mm.
London's pretty flat. Berlin's definitely flat. I'm going to look up the course.
Yeah, okay. I hadn't even thought about that. But surely the ocean would count for something. You know, a city where you can dive into that beautiful ocean after a run.
That would
be. It's got to boost the rep.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but I didn't.
Because I remember this is the thing, you go on tours and you can't necessarily commit, you can't believe everything you hear. But I was under the impression that Manhattan was a word that meant the land of many hills.
Mm.
Oh, really?
Which would mean it's not flat. But I agree with you, you can walk blocks and blocks and blocks and not really feel it.
Mm.
Mm.
So I don't know. Yeah, maybe the landscape became urbanised and flattened.
Yeah, probably.
From all the walking.
Mm. Yeah.
San Francisco. Now, that's a hilly city, isn't
it? Yeah, that one's hilly.
That would be absolutely brutal. But I was also looking into I mean, it's a huge day, these marathons, especially these ones that are major world events or like major marathons, is to break the Guinness World Records, to get your name in the book.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And I think the main one that was kind of causing a stir was a man completed it, the 42 kilometres, wearing 53 pairs of underwear.
What?
53, yeah, which was breaking the record for guess how many? 52.
No way.
Up to the one.
One over.
That's 5 kilograms
one up
of them. Extra weight. I mean, that's an, it's like wearing multiple nappies, essentially.
5 kgs.
Of underwear. I just was like, what brief did he go for? Did he go for a high cut? Did he go for a boy leg? Did he go for, I mean, it would almost be tactical to go for a high cut brief, I'm imagining, because you'd want to avoid, you can't avoid chafing with 53.
That's happening. What are you just covering yourself in oil every kilometre or something?
I don't know. But the one positive I was thinking with 53 pairs of underwears, you can't get a wedgie, I don't think. Or can you? Oh, maybe they can. They can just, yeah, okay. The base, ground zero, would be able to creep up there, I guess.
Maybe,
but
instead of for the stall gift, like instead of the handicap being distance.
50 pairs of
undies. Yeah, 50 pairs of undies.
50 pairs of underwear. That's it. We want to see you waddle and chafe across the finish line.
Kathy Freeman, we saw you start, we've seen your handicap and you still won. So you're wearing extra undies.
We're going to need to see you in the change room.
Here's 30 bog catches.
But that's it. A man has run a half marathon wearing 120 t-shirts. That was in an incredibly cold climate based off the pictures. But, and then there's a heap of others. You know, someone got the record for the fastest time. I don't know if it's the fastest time or it's just the first wearing certain costumes. It seems like a matter if you want a world record for a marathon. It's like think of a costume that hasn't been worn.
Yeah.
And wear it across the line.
Yep.
Boom, you're in the book.
There you
on
go.
The one hand, it's impressive because you've still completed a marathon. On the other hand, it's like, yeah, someone did it in a school uniform, not a sports uniform.
Does that include shoes? That would be hard.
I didn't think about the shoes. New shoes. Now, that is tough. That would be harder than I would say. I would argue new school shoes, harder than 53 pairs of underwear.
Yeah.
Or you don't have to agree, but
I wonder the Roman sandals. Are they still part of the school uniform? Maybe not. That is full marathon.
Open toe sandals. The Roman sandals.
Yeah.
Okay.
Remember those ones?
I'm not sure. No, I don't remember wearing them to school. Just the classic black lace-ups.
They were all the rage at St. Pat's in Albury.
Did you wear any Roman sandals to school?
No, I've been seeing kids going to school in black shoes that are not, they're clearly too comfortable. And I'm like, where is the pain? Like, I'm like, no wonder the new generation is totally soft.
You should have painful shoes.
Yeah, but
God's, be walking uphill both ways to and from school.
53 pairs of jocks on.
Whereas your braces, your complexion looks clear. Well, I mean, the skincare as well, these kids would have access to now. It's like, where are the spots on the face? I remember the T-bars. They were maybe more that girls wore T-bars, but I remember I thought that they were quite a fashion statement. I used to wear my school shoes outside of school. I don't know. Maybe that was – I tried to make it a thing, but I don't know whether it
– so it's
maybe
catching on.
Yeah, slowly but surely you'll get there. Maybe that could be a Guinness World Record, a marathon in T-bars.
Yes. I look at it. I just had a quick look at the course. It starts in North Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
Must be around Crow's Nest, somewhere around there.
Okay, that doesn't mean much to me, but the crow flies.
Yeah. Well, as the crow flies south over the bridge,
mm-hmm.
then a bit of a lap of like Circular Bay, around a little bit through the city, finish at Sydney Opera House forecourt. Looks like a really fun course. But the bit I'd like to zoom in on is running across the bridge.
Yeah.
How many people are entering? 30,000?
I think there was 33,000 to 35,000.
Didn't seem – was a massive problem a couple of weeks ago.
That's so true.
Seems like it's easy, don't
it? Yeah. Permits, no problem. Oh, we're hosting a marathon.
Yeah, go for it. Yeah. How many? 30,000?
Yeah. Oh, no worries.
Yeah, we'll get that sorted for you. I don't know. It's funny how things work, isn't it? Maybe that's what you have to do if you're organising a protest. Just be really fast.
Call it a marathon.
Yeah.
I think that would work on a lot of levels, to be honest.
Melbourne's own. Triple R.
Andy Griffiths is a children's author and passionate purveyor of silliness who over 25 plus years is Australia's fastest and highest selling author with his beloved Just series, including Just Tricking, Just Stupid and Just Doomed, his Bum series, including The Day My Bum Went Psycho, the Treehouse series, his New York Times best-selling partnership with Terry Denton, as well as The Cat on the Hat, Cat on the Mat is Flat, The Big Fat Cow That Goes Kapow, and last year's The Land of Lost Things, the first in his Adventure Unlimited series. Now, and he's back with You and Me and the Peanut Butter Beast with illustrations by Bill Hoper to tell us about it, the dapperly dressed punk peddler of nonsense, joins us now. Andy, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
How long has this one been gestating? Do they all fold up over one another? There are just so many, it's hard to keep track.
Yeah, this one has been requested by readers for many years. One of the most common requests is, can you put me in the book? You know, you put me and my mum and dad, we all love the books, and me and my dog. And I was musing on this, how do I get the reader into the book, given that there are many different readers and all different sizes, shapes, nationalities, genders. And I met Bill Hope, the illustrator of this particular series, and he suggested, why don't we put a box on their head, like a cardboard adventure helmet, and fully clothed adventure helmets, and I can talk to the reader and remind them of all the amazing fictional adventures we've had. So that's how it began.
Love that. Yeah, there's a lot of callbacks, it seems, almost. In the book, there's always references to adventures past.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. And that's how I interact with kids. I love to just assume instant familiarity and say, oh, there you are again. Hey? Yeah. And I love telling them something slightly outrageous and having them challenge me. Well, that can't be true. And then it puts me into a fighting position where I've got to come up with whatever ridiculous justification I can. Mm. And that's where the story comes from.
That's your creative process, putting yourself in a corner.
Yeah, I love that.
And then fighting your way out.
What about this story? You're going to the centre of the earth?
Well, we started with the whole me and you. Hey, remember that time we were walking through the forest and we found that really deep hole? And you said, how deep is that hole? And I said, well, let's throw a rock down the bottom. We'll count the seconds until it hits the bottom and then we'll do the calculation. But we dropped the rock and we never heard it hit the bottom. Mm. And then you said, I've got a better idea. And I said, what's that? And you said, I'm going to jump in. I said, no. But it was too late. You'd already jumped in. So that was the opening paragraph. And, of course, one of the most famous books in the world is Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which begins with the long fall down the hole. I've just improved on that. They fall down four holes and waste about 50 or 60 pages.
Is no idea too stupid? Do you ever go, Andy, rein it in, this is absolutely nuts?
No, the more stupid, the more interested I'm how do we make this happen? Day My Bum Went Psycho was just a one line, it was a title, and it was a joke. At the end of a talk, the kids would say, what are you going to write next? And I said, I'm going to write something serious next. And they go, oh. And I go, yeah, well, it's called The Day My Bum Went Psycho. And there's nothing funny about that. And so that was just a line in the talks for a few years. And the publisher finally said, are you actually going to write this book? And I said, I had no intention really, but now wouldn't it be fun? Why would a bum go psycho? What would it be like to be a bum? It wouldn't be much fun trapped in the underpants all day long. You'd be jealous of the head. You'd want to rearrange the human
human body if you could somehow, and off it goes.
Oh, that sounds so like so much fun. Do you ever find yourself in a serious mood, maybe when you are on maybe a deadline for, you know, the day my bum went psycho? And do you ever, like, what do you do to tap into that silly place?
Well, I'm absolutely serious when I'm writing a very silly book.
Yeah, okay.
I'm actually dealing with it very seriously. I'm not trying to be funny.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, if your bum detached itself and ran away, what would you do?
Yeah.
If it was a dog, you'd call the dog catcher, so maybe you'd call the bum catcher.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of a logical progression based off a ridiculous premise, and that's very exciting, that combination.
Well, you have an honours in literature. How many kind of Easter eggs do you put in for yourself?
Maybe there's a
highfalutin allusion that you don't expect anyone to necessarily get, but maybe it informed the adventure.
Well, there was someone did an MA thesis on the intertextual references in The Day My Bum Went Psycho, because they chased the great white bum, which of course is Moby Dick. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. I'm always in the first You and Me book, they are lost and they find a bathtub and they hook up all these lost socks which are flapping around their heads, and they millions of lost socks are attached to the bathtub, and then they go flying through, and that looks exactly like James and the Giant Peach.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So I'm using all of the classic children's books and references just to reimagine and bring them up to date for a new audience.
Mm.
So I feel like I'm passing on what I loved to a new generation.
Mm. You've made me start pronouncing peanut butter in an unusual way.
That was the illustrator. That was Bill's fault. Every time the peanut butter monster says peanut butter
yes.
or peanut bitter or whatever.
Like, do catchphrases come back to you often
in your
talking to kids and your audience, and they're like, are you surprised what sticks? Or you can anticipate
it these days? I'm surprised I'm still here after 25 years, to tell you the truth. Mm. But they will pick up on, they have loved that exact thing. They love all the different ways that the beast says peanut butter, and they love the hole, all the stuff happening in the hole, because as we fall, you get hungry. So we have to, you say, anything to eat? And I say, well, I've got some bread here. You got some peanut butter? Yeah, I've got it here. Knife, table. So they're having a lovely feast.
Yes.
And I figured at the bottom, they hit the bottom, they get peanut butter all over them, and what would be the worst possible thing is a beast that eats peanut butter.
Mm.
Waiting for them at the bottom. And then I'm bringing in King Kong, which is a movie
naturally.
I've always loved. And my nemesis villains, Johnny and Jimmy Knucklehead, are down in the centre of the earth searching for this beast so they can bring it up to the surface and the predictable mayhem ensues.
Why is some comedy children's comedy? There's a lot of stupid comedy for grown-ups as well.
Yeah, well, I'm not writing for children as such. The first audience is me, Bill, Terry with the treehouse, and my wife Jill, which, to answer your previous question, she will call time if it's getting too stupid. I wanted to have a barking dog, Barky the barking dog in treehouse. Terry watches this endless program. It's just a dog barking panel after panel. And I said, that can go for about 100 pages. Really test the reader's patience and that sort of nonsense humour.
Mm.
And Jill said, I don't think 100 pages is going to, you can have two.
Yeah, nice.
I said, no, 10. She said, six, that's my last offer. So Jill is a sort of middle, the general reader.
Yeah.
Who knows when the story has gone off.
Mm-hmm.
And me and the illustrator are going off onto a conceptual humour that's incredibly funny to us, but maybe not bringing everyone in.
What about the idea of other authors, footballers, whatever, getting involved in your racket. Are you at peace with everybody reckons they've got a children's book in them?
They come and they go. You know, George Saunders, one of my heroes, the American writer, he's, yeah, to me he's like the new Kurt Vonnegut, well, the old Kurt Vonnegut. Yeah. He says writing is a very inviting thing. It's like a boxing ring. Anyone can get into the boxing ring and have a few swings and fight. But it's really hard to stay in the ring for very long. Mm. And so, yeah, you see people come and go and, yeah, stay. Whatever. I'm not threatened by them. I've done my training over years. And I always went in assuming that to write a book that really involves children and really, you know, gets their hearts and wants them to make them read more is a very difficult thing because there's a lot of competition out there for everyone's attention. So I probably over-trained and over-prepared and thought I've got to really find how do you get to the reader. And my particular style is a very personal style. It's like I see you as the reader. I know you're reading the book. I often make references to the actual act of reading. So the reader feels recognised. And this was Roald Dahl's theory that all children need to be recognised for the special person they are, you know, in whatever way that is. And you see that in a book like Matilda. Her parents don't see anything special about her, but Miss Honey does. And when someone in your life, whether it's a parent, a teacher, maybe another person, a friend, recognises you, that's a very special thing.
Yeah. When reading and writing data comes out or, you know, NAPLAN results or whatever about the state of reading amongst kids, does the government tap you on the shoulder or do you have particular opinions?
Well, and blame me. Could you write a bit better, please?
Yeah. Yes, they're all writing about psycho bums.
No, the government doesn't tap me, but my response to that is to just continue to write the very best books that I can. When I started the Just books, they were a very different type of literature to what was around because I was brought up, you know, raised by Triple R, alternative music, alternative comedy, as something like The Young Ones. Mm. I just went, I want that punk rock energy in a book and I can't see it reflected in modern children's literature. So that's what I started with. And it's really gratifying now, and I'm sure some of your listeners might be amongst those early readers of just disgusting and just crazy. And they are now coming to the signings and events and holding their battered copies of the books going, you made my childhood. Ugh. And, you know, these were the only books I wanted to read. And, you know, and that's a real nice, what am I trying to say?
I know you're the writer.
I know I need my editor. Yeah. I'm just a hack. It's completing the circle.
Mm.
Yeah, I feel like I've done it. I've given a new generation the magic and the chaos and the beauty of what I love about
what
reading.
A legacy, and you've only just started. The book is You and Me and the Peanut Butter Beast. It's illustrated by Bill Hope and the author is the number one best-selling Andy Griffiths. What a pleasure. What are you listening to? Are you listening to much music?
Yes, all the time,
all the time.
Non-stop.
Yeah.
Thanks to my friend Richie at Strange World Records, which has a new location. I always had Stephen Walker, the ghost. He was my musical guru for many years, taking me down those byways.
Yeah, and talk about legacy.
In terms
of taste as well.
Yeah, so Richie's taken over and, OC's. OC's sort of bring everything together for me. He's an incredible musician, John Dwyer.
Well, Andy Griffiths, keep it up. You and Me and the Peanut Butter Beast. It's out via Panic Millen and it's been a great pleasure to chat once again. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Woo! That's right. Triple R.
Zoe Coldham is a filmmaker and photographer whose debut documentary short, Charlotte, won Best Documentary at St Kilda Film Festival, and whose credits as a camera operator include the feature-length documentaries Now Sound, Melbourne's Listening, and The Art of Incarceration, both of which premiered at MIF. Zoe's latest project is Gore Street, Fitzroy, that traces the history of the approximately 800-metre stretch from Alexander Parade to Gertrude Street in Melbourne's oldest suburb. And to tell us about it, the award-winning filmmaker and former resident joins us now. Zoe, welcome to Breakfasters.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How big has Gore Street loomed in your life?
The street? Well, I grew up there, so I've lived there like my whole life. I now don't live there anymore, but my dad still does, and I'm constantly going back there. So I guess it's always looming, but it's changed a lot throughout my life. And I think as a teenager, it was sort of in its artistic phase where I'm sure a lot of people would remember Brunswick Street was popping off. There was a lot of art happening. There was a fringe festival. But that was just kind of normal for me. And then it sort of went through gentrification as I was growing up. So I sort of saw parts of it disappear and change and evolve. And as I was becoming a filmmaker and a storyteller, I felt this urge to capture what might be lost eventually.
Because before you were born, at what point is it widely regarded that the reputation of Fitzroy and Gore Street as a slum area was kind of gone?
Oh, that's a good question.
But you certainly have no memory of it as a child, necessarily.
Well being growing up there, it was quite, it was very quiet. It was quite desolate in some times. There was a lot of drugs on Smith Street, which is just down the road from Gore Street. We actually had to walk to the video shop in a very specific way so as not to get offered heroin on the streets. so it wasn't a thriving place, I guess. There wasn't that many kids around, but it also had an element of like a really strong community just because of, I guess, when it was considered slums was more in the 50s and 60s, but there were heaps of people living there and they all kind of like looked after each other. There's a very strong sense of community, and that kind of continued on when the waves of migration came along in the 1970s, and then later when refugees came into the housing estates as well.
And we meet some long-time residents.
Yes. Yeah, that's the whole idea.
Who paid not a lot.
Yes, that's right.
$5,000 for a house on Gore Street.
Maybe considered one of the most desirable streets in Melbourne, I would argue.
Yeah,
hazard a guess. Yeah.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's Jim, and he's the oldest resident on the street. And yeah, he bought his house for $5,000, and then he jokes that he paid $10,000 for a plot at the Carlton Cemetery.
Wild.
And so now, did you discover anything unusual as you throughout your investigations into this kind of, it's iconic, it's almost, you'd want to call it, locally iconic strip of Gore Street?
Yeah, I always thought that it had stories and it was interesting, but even making this, I uncovered stuff that I didn't even know. So Fitzroy has a really important, like, Indigenous history, and especially on Gertrude Street, which crosses over Gore Street. That was a place where a lot of the Aboriginal health services and various services were set up. So actually, when Muhammad Ali came to Melbourne for a fight in the 1960s, he said to someone after the fight, "Oh, well, I want to know where, you know, the real Indigenous people live." And they said, "Well, you've got to go to Fitzroy and you've got to go to the Builder's Arms, which is on the corner of Gertrude Street and Gore Street." And apparently he went to the Builder's Arms and he was outside there, like, giving a speech. And, like, there was five trams, like, banked up down the street, 200 people there. Not one person took a photo.
Wow.
Sucks for a filmmaker.
Yeah.
That probably speaks to the times, you know. Maybe cameras weren't something that people could afford in the area at that time.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point.
And I guess the process of making this film might have been, just a real testament to oral history as well and the stories that, your neighbours keep or the publicans and just that there's not necessarily footage of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big part of making this film was there's lots of new people moving into Fitzroy all the time, and if they learn some of the history through watching this film and other avenues, then they'll be more inclined to understand it and then want to protect it. Mm. And that goes with the buildings, heritage not being erased in that way, but then the heritage of storytelling as well that we should hold on to.
Yeah, it was a beautiful watch, and I learned so much, but it's also an incredibly like personal lens that you apply to the street and to the house growing up there. Yeah, I'm curious, like, your experience with your memories as a child, did you kind of feel like you were living somewhere unique or different maybe to other people, or was there any comparison?
No, not really. I think where you live when you're young, that just is what it is. But I do remember just dreaming of like white picket fence and a lawn and like playing with kids in the street like you see in the movies, and that definitely wasn't the case.
Mm. But your father was an architect, right? Is that
what he is? My dad's brother.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so he bought a house in Gore Street, and then he convinced my dad to buy the house next door when it became available, because he just saw that it had been happening in a lot of different suburbs, that anywhere close to the city would become more desirable place to live. And, but a lot of the houses were fated for demolition, and they'd just come and demolish them in the middle of the night, even against, when they weren't really allowed to.
In the middle of the night?
Yeah.
The nerve!
And my dad actually did the renovation for our house using some of the demolished, you know, parts of other houses that he would then go and get.
Wow, so good.
So what makes architecturally Gore Street identifiable?
Oh, that's a really good question. Mm.
But it does matter that they're two stories next to the CBD's just over there with skyscrapers, and then we dramatically reduce the sizes.
Yes, that's a good point. I think when it goes down to like single story or double story, it means that then individuals can own and buy the houses, and then they can live there and do them up. And that's what happened with a lot of the Italian people and the Greek people that came. They sort of bought these houses, and they were very proud of the houses, and they spent a lot of time making them nicer. Mm. So, yeah, we have that to thank for how good it looks sometimes.
I've also got a question, maybe a bit random, but you mentioned your dad's an engineer, and there's footage in this film of a young girl in a gnarly swing in the backyard. Did your dad build that swing, and is that you?
I'm sure... I don't know if my dad actually built that swing, but I'm sure he hung it from a very long rope and terrified us.
It was in this small courtyard. This small child is swinging, from a rope, but it looks fun. I'd pay to go on that swing.
It looks fun. Does it look scary, Nat?
Yeah, it's got an element of, like, thrill to it, adrenaline rush.
Because I feel validated, because I used to find that terrifying, and I would scream and my dad would say, stop screaming, it's not scary.
Incredible engine.
Yeah.
The Russian house, cops mention, you go inside. There, you know, that space, I've seen gigs in there. And then it makes me think of this screening that you're about to have, a Fitzroy Town Hall Ballroom, which is also an extraordinary space.
Yeah. Russian house, isn't it? Because they have lots of raves there as well, which is quite funny. Like,
it's hilarious.
They have all kinds of stuff. It's basically a cultural centre for Russian people to come and connect with their culture. And they have the oldest and largest library of Russian books there as well. But they basically host various events to raise money to keep the building restored. So, there's lots of interesting buildings, and Fitzroy Town Hall as well, which is on Napier Street. That's where I'll be hosting this screening. The ballroom there is beautiful, and above the stage where the film's going to be playing, it says City of Fitzroy. So it's just perfect.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
And there'll be a speaker. You'll have a poem reading by Pio.
Yes.
Wow.
Who was in the studio not long ago and teeing off on gentrification.
Yeah, so that'll be good.
So perfect.
Yeah.
Daring.
I don't imagine Pio holding back.
Totally. All right. Yeah. That'll be fun. So that's Friday the 19th of September at 6:30 p.m. How shall we find out about that? Where do you want to direct us?
So tickets have actually sold out.
Oh, cool.
Good for you.
What are we talking to you for?
Yeah, I know. But really, there's been so much interest and it's really amazing. Like, it just goes to show people are interested in the history. So we actually had the premiere in February, and that was outside the Union, and we blocked off the street and had a street party.
Cool.
And that sold out. And now we've got the Melbourne Town Hall one, which is sold out really quickly. So there's a wait list now on where you can get the tickets. And I'm sure we'll do another screening. By demand. Yeah, you know.
Congratulations. Well, people want their fix of Gore Street.
Yeah, apparently.
And you on the swing.
It's a cool swing.
Yeah. All right. Well, Gore Street Fitzroy is the name of the documentary. Zoe Coldham is the director who we've been speaking with. Congratulations and thanks very much.
Thank you.
Triple R.
Friday, Punny Bugger and Geelong Golden Boy, Jonathan Schuster's back in the house. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning. Happy Friday, everyone.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Geelong tonight at the G.
Watch out.
I bought a new scarf. I can't wait to be shaking it around.
Lovely actor, but nothing says fair weather supporter this year than buying a new scarf.
I know. Well, for the finals. I realised I lost my scarf and okay. I don't know where it went. So, which is, you know, I feel like there's an old bloke going at home like, you never lose your scarf. I've had me scarf for 90 years.
Yeah, you've got to get some pills on it somehow or put it through the washing machine with some bricks or something.
thanks for having me, everyone. I just wanted to talk about I called my mum a few weeks ago. She's in a nightmare world. So we sold our family home. My sister was upset. It wasn't, I'm not really, I don't hold on to, memories.
Move on, move up,
I say. Mum got a nice little apartment.
So it's not cognitive decline, it's a mindset.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. That's what you said to your mum as she's crying. Move on.
The pipes work now in your new little apartment, Mum, and now she's at this new place. But just nightmare. Mm-hmm. Plovers have set up in her back little area.
It's a nice welcoming party.
Yeah, they hate her.
Wow. So just to confirm, plovers, are they ground-dwelling birds?
Yeah. Yep. They're the ones. I heard one before when I was out the back. They make that they hate it. They're so aggressive. I hate
Finish that sentence. You hate?
I think they're the worst bird on the planet and I think we should annihilate them all is my opinion.
So a few people have heard this. You wouldn't be alone.
I feel like you guys would have some animal expert come on here and be like, they're misunderstood. Like, what are we misunderstanding? Like, they are the worst, but they're so aggressive. They're attacking my mum, so now it's personal.
Yeah.
I think they're a brutal creature. Even to the point where she, like, runs inside after, like, putting her washing on and they come up to the back door and stare at her through the glass and start, like, attacking her.
So psychologically as well, they're trying to intimidate her.
Yeah.
Mind games.
They're a little psycho bird.
Yeah.
So when I hate something, what I do is I then Google it to try and hate it more.
Okay.
Get in its head.
So they've got delicious eggs. Their eggs are a delicacy.
Really? Is it like quail eggs or something?
Yeah, very much like quail eggs. So I would think if I had delicious eggs, I would be on my best behaviour around humans. I wouldn't try and attack them.
No.
Right? Because I just get the thought now where I want to go and take their eggs and dip my soldiers into them. But I'm not.
And you're not even hungry.
Why not?
About that.
Why won't you?
They're a protected species.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
They're protected. I don't know.
They don't know that they're protected, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
But it's annoying that they're we've got so many beautiful birds in our little, great, beautiful Australia.
Yes. Yeah.
And this bird is just ruining it for the rest of them, in my opinion. They've had millions of years evolving to have sharp spines under their armpits.
Oh,
really?
Wow. Yeah. So when they attack, they can hurt you even more.
Armpits?
Yeah, just under their wing. I don't know if they've got armpits. Yeah. And during those million years, they didn't even think to make a nest in a tree. They're morons.
And they can't fly.
What do you mean?
They can't fly.
Are you talking about chickens or plovers?
Plovers.
Ah.
They can. They swoop you.
Pardon? Plovers, I thought they were ground dwelling birds.
They lay their eggs in the ground, but they fly.
Okay.
Have you never been swooped by one?
Oh no, I'm thinking of a different bird then, I guess. Or am I?
All right, we need I'm not an idiot, and neither are you. No offense.
Plovers. I don't know. I think some other people might. Plovers. I didn't think they flew. Anyway, keep going.
They're called mast lap wings. They're masked because they're ugly.
Gotcha.
They are like those people who buy an apartment next to a music venue and then complain. And then recently there was an article that came out where these plovers just laid their egg because they lay their eggs on fields and stuff. So they laid their eggs on a football field, and now all the football players had to move to another location because they weren't allowed. Because if you move the eggs, they abandon their chicks. So if I go to Geelong v Brisbane tonight and a bird decided to, like, lay their eggs on the MCG, game over. We're not even playing.
Because you've got to tiptoe around their bad parenting.
Exactly.
Mm. Maybe.
It's disgusting behaviour. Oh, sorry, Snoop Dogg, you can't play. There's a bird decided to lay eggs on the grand final eve.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cancelled. AFL cancelled.
Maybe, yeah. I reckon that'd help out Darcy Vessio, back pocket, preemie, Carlton.
Have a few swoops on the side.
Yeah. Plovers.
Do you think that they abandon them because they can't find them or they're just like, I can't be bothered looking?
I can't be stressed. The stress gets to them.
Can't be bothered.
I'm moving on.
And the worst thing, they love each other. The birds stay together forever. They both look after the chicks.
That's definitely the worst thing.
I'm single, right? I'm at home on Instagram sending recipes to myself because there's no one to share it with. Meanwhile, they love one another.
Plovers are off having times of their life. I would thought that might bring you around because you're a bit of a romantic.
I love. I do love.
But when it comes to plovers loving each other, no.
If you got spikes under your arm and you abandon your child, you are not a fan of mine.
No, okay. You'll like this, Jonathan, as well. I typed in, I was going to look whether they fly or not. Do plovers fly? They do. But the first thing that comes up, do plovers have poison? So they're reps out there.
I think they do, don't they?
I think it's a myth. I Googled it.
Damn it.
That's all right. But anyway, so I called Mum yesterday. I said, I'm gonna stand up for you, Mum. I'm gonna go on and do plover hate. And Mum's fallen in love with the chicks. She said it's really cute. She said that the other day it was pissing down with rain and she looked out and the mother plover was protecting her three little chicks and she said she wants to nominate that plover for Mother of the Year.
Nice. Mother plover sounds like a Snoop Dogg substitute for one of his lyrics.
So my lesson I learned is when you see red, you don't get to see the rest of the rainbow.
Oh.
That's a quote I made up. Isn't that a good one?
It's really good.
That's up there with Dolly Parton's one.
Yeah.
What's her rainbow one? It's like, you don't get to see the rainbow if you don't go through the rain.
Yeah. Mine's better than Dolly's, I reckon.
Way better.
Yeah. And then I called Dad up and he's a big fan. He's a big nature guy, so he loves them as well.
He loves
them. So everyone loves them. They're protected. They're not bad.
So they're bullying your mum, but she loves them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Playing
so
hard
they've
to get.
Got a
playing
spiky spine, and it turns out your mum's spineless. No, I wouldn't
say that. That is true, and I made sure she was listening in today. So that was,
I'm sorry, Gail.
That was Nat Harris.
I'm sorry, Gail Schuster. I loved your show on Triple R with Jonathan. Key Change.
Nice.
Yeah. What a great show.
Mm.
Thank you. You don't have to do that.
I loved that one. That was so good.
Oh, thank you. I think it's still on the website, Key Changes.
Yeah.
It was. I just wanted it to be heartwarming and nice.
It was beautiful. I listened to it with my mum.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, it is nice.
I don't mind plovers at all. I just was being facetious.
Oh, okay. Because, you don't want to be consumed with rage.
No. There's too much hate in the world.
Well, I'm glad you got it off your chest, though.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I do wonder whether, because you got me all worked up and I was all anti, and then you're just like, oh, by the way, I'm pro-plover.
I'm I
haven't gone through this process that you have.
Yeah.
You've trapped me in hate.
Yeah. My advice, dip a soldier into one of their eggs and it'll all be good.
Yeah, right.
It's like, how do you move past the spiky spine?
Yeah.
Under the armpit? That's some sinister stuff.
They're psychos, but you got to love a psycho every now and
exactly.
then.
Exactly. Yeah, Jonathan Schuster, is there anything you want to point out ears and eyeballs towards?
I'm doing a footy show on the 24th at Cooper's Inn. We do
I want to go to this.
They're real fun. I guess at parlour games we get our very talented comedian friends to come in and play football characters, and it's been a big year for footy, so I'm excited.
Big year for footy.
Yeah,
2025,
yeah.
Who would have thought?
And chookers for tonight.
Thank you.
In the nosebleed section.
Anya Cadden. Triple
R. Thanks for listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters, the Monday to Friday breakfast show broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.